great.
Well, thank you for being here. I'd like to share with you some of my observations on this very intriguing medieval woman. And I hope that maybe you'll be interested in learning a little bit more about her. So now, before I begin, I'm going to advance to the next slide, which has a music clip and some slides. It is of a religious nature, and I feel that in discussing Byzantine civilization, which is an Orthodox Christian civilization and very, very Christian, we ought to set the mood with a little bit of liturgy. So. I get goose pimples every time I hear that. The resurrection is the most important holiday, holy day in the Orthodox calendar. Now, negotiating gender with Anna Komnena. Anna Komnena, purple-born princess of the Komnenos dynasty, daughter of one of the greatest Roman Byzantine emperors, Alexius I, highly educated author of a biography of her father, the Alexiad, and disappointed aspirant to the imperial throne, stands out among both women and men of the pre-modern period. She came from a family where women were used to wielding power and brokering it, and she fully expected to inherit the throne along with her husband, the heir designate, on her father's death. Instead, when her society was unprepared for her crossing traditional gender roles and as something of an outlet for her ultimate powerlessness, while under house arrest for having plotted to assassinate her brother, the Emperor John, she gathered around her the brightest intellectuals of her day and cultivated a revival of interest in Aristotle, Ptolemy, and Euclid. As part of this effort, she created one of the liveliest, most colorful, passionate, and human biographies ever written. Like all works of history, this one is not without an ulterior motive, as I shall explain. But on each magnificently written page, with a style meant to evoke the heroic Greek past, there is no doubt about her love for her father. I feel with emotion to read it, especially pathos-filled passages such as her account of her father's decline and death. By the way, as a result of her vast education, Anna knew enough medicine to advise the imperial physicians, at least by her account. I myself have loved the Alexiad since I was a child, when my mother was studying Byzantine art history in graduate school and read the book. She liked it and shared it with me, and so Anna and Alexios were occasional guests at our dinner table as topics of conversation, of course. And I'm delighted that I finally feel competent enough to deal with Anna on a scholarly level and to share her life and work with others. After laying a contextual framework, I shall proceed by giving historical background to her times, placing her father's reign in context, and then I shall address her history and how it reflects both her character and her times. Now, what happened there? Well, you never know about technology. Oh, well. Because she was a prolific female author, Anna is one of the better-known Byzantine figures better known to scholars of Western Europe. But her significance within her own culture is little known, and Byzantium is largely a dark continent in the European consciousness. Typical history or philosophy textbooks of my youth skipped from the 6th century Boethius to the 13th century Thomas Aquinas, if they're generous, but usually skipped to the Renaissance, giving a misleading impression that nothing of importance occurred in between. By implication, neither Islamic nor Byzantine civilizations contributed anything of significance to the unfolding of European civilization, which is really the only one that counts, after all. Specialist historians, however, see matters rather differently. Renaissance scholars know a little bit more about the migration of Byzantine scholars to Italy, bringing their knowledge of Greek and their manuscripts to the West, making the Renaissance possible in the first place. But the extent of this migration is not generally known, because once they deposited their manuscripts and taught their students, Greeks play no further part in the autobiography of the West. And yet, Byzantine exiles were in every European nation, and, were the full truth known, they undoubtedly provided a cultural leavening in those societies. And I myself belong to this Byzantine diaspora, a fact that has not always pleased me, but it does now. In Anna's case, her pivotal role in the revival of classical Greek learning in her own Greek society was not known even to Byzantinists until a generation ago, and has still not been explored in any depth. The reasons for this are unknown to me, except that perhaps her gender and her controversial life may have contributed to this oblivion. How scholars throughout history have viewed the sources of their own intellectual traditions, especially when it involved another culture, is a fascinating subject. Anna herself seems wholly oblivious to the debt that she and her society owed to the prior intellectual ferment that occurred in the Baghdad Caliphate 2 centuries earlier, that's in Islam, a period that has been called, with delicious and appropriate irony, the First Renaissance of Baghdad. The Byzantine Empire, or the Eastern Roman Empire as it is more properly called, was in serious trouble when Alexius Komnenos seized power in 1081 and founded a new dynasty, incidentally with the assistance of two powerful women, his mother and the widow of a former emperor. The empire had been in almost unmitigated decline since the death a half century earlier of Basil II, one of the most effective military emperors in Byzantine history, as his nickname, the Bulgar Slayer, evokes. But Basil had failed to provide for his succession, and so rule went to a series of good-for-nothing husbands of his two nieces for the next several decades, who squandered his legacy. One of these men foolishly disbanded troops guarding Eastern Asia Minor in order to use the money closer to home. The timing could not have been worse. The Middle East was teeming with Turkish tribesmen seeking permanent settlements, and now they had free passage into Asia Minor, where they have remained to this day. Well, their descendants, that is. No single act contributed more to the ultimate downfall of the empire. Alexius and some of his successors managed to gain back some of this territory, but without the heartland of their empire, the ultimate fall of the Roman Empire seemed inevitable. This is the situation in 1081. Now, these are the remnants of the Eastern Roman Empire, which used to embrace used to encompass the entire Eastern Mediterranean. And you can see that what is today Turkey has been mostly overrun. Now, Alexius and his successors were somewhat successful in gaining territory back, and so by a century later, this is what the empire consisted of. Alexios faced invasion on three fronts: the Turks from the east, the Pechenegs from the north, and the Normans from the west. Of these, the Normans were the most dangerous. An army of Normans for whom the province of Normandy had grown too small had established themselves as rulers of southern Italy. Their leader, Robert Guiscard, had designs on Constantinople and the empire. Normans were the most effective fighting force in this period, remember, who defeated Harold at Hastings in 1066. And they might have defeated Byzantium too, had it not been for Alexios. I'm setting the framework here for the epic character of this biography. The greatest danger of all to the empire was the coming of the First Crusade. Scores of thousands of uncouth and unwelcome barbarians from the west swarmed in the empire. Anna observed that all Westerners, and she uses the term Celt, which evokes the ancient enemies of Greece, distantly related to the ancient Gauls, one of the ancestral groups of the medieval French crusaders, that these people are by nature greedy, oath-breakers, and easily bought with gold, and that they all covet Byzantine princesses as wives, and that they all want to take over the Byzantine throne. There's probably a little bit of exaggeration there. Lacking in manners, one of the crusaders, while their leaders met with the emperor, sat on the imperial throne. What effrontery. The Alexiad is available in an inexpensive Penguin edition. This is the latest printing. By the way, the picture on the poster that you received was not that of Anna, that was Alexius. The imperial crown had dangling pearls and gems around its rim. This is her father. I have found it to open the work, Anna sets forth her reasons for writing it, and I'm going to quote. The stream of time, irresistible, ever moving, carries off and bears away all things that come to birth and plunges them into utter darkness, both deeds of no account and deeds that are mighty and worthy of commemoration. Nevertheless, the science of history is a great bulwark against this stream of time. I, having realized the effects wrought by time, desire now to give an account of my father's deeds, which do not deserve to be consigned to forgetfulness, nor to be swept away on the flood of time in an ocean of non-remembrance. She writes to prevent the great deeds of her father from being forgotten. Yet it has recently been argued that Alexius's memory was not likely to fade. His successors kept it alive to bolster their own legitimacy. Yet their politically caricatured Alexius was different from the Alexius that Anna remembered, and it is her Alexius, not without her own political agenda, of course, that she immortalizes in her biography. As her history shows, Anna was a careful student of the ancient Greek historians, especially Thucydides. She might have enjoyed knowing about Livia Drusilla, the woman behind her father's great predecessor Augustus, the first emperor of Rome. However, as she could not read Latin, like perhaps all of her fellow Byzantines, it is unclear how much Roman history proper she knew. Pity that she did not know Tacitus or Livy. Unlike them, however, and this is one of the turning points in historical literature in the West, Anna is a strong authorial presence, as this passage shows. I'll quote again. I, Anna, daughter of the Emperor Alexius and the Empress Irene, born and bred in the purple, not without some acquaintance with literature, having devoted most earnest study to the Greek language, in fact, and being not unpracticed in rhetoric, and having read thoroughly the treatises of Aristotle and the dialogues of Plato, and having fortified my mind with the quadrivium of sciences, these things must be divulged, and it is not self-advertisement to recall what nature and my own zeal for knowledge have given me, nor what God has apportioned to me from above, and what has been contributed by opportunity. Now, to me, that doesn't come across as arrogant. It might to you, but you have to take it in context. Throughout her narrative, she tells readers exactly how she feels about specific persons, events, or policies, and it's not always pretty. As such, Anna Komnena pioneered a new kind of writing, prose with an unconcealed subjectivity. Edward Gibbon, however, not one for less than the masculine objective history, dismissed her work completely as the rantings of an emotional woman. The epic dimension. The Alexiad self-consciously evokes the epics of Homer. How could the story of the salvation of the Roman Empire, the Christian Roman Empire, no less, from barbarian hordes not be epic? Anna frequently quotes Homer, and her title even reflects that of the Iliad, Alexiad Iliad. Character development is similar to Homer's, and her battle descriptions remind us of the same. How strange! A Byzantine woman, some 18 years at least, and several cultures removed from the historical Homer, or Homer's, quotes him like scripture. Why? In Anna's day, Homer was central to Byzantine education and quoted from memory by most educated people, including Anna. Under Alexius, there was a renaissance of interest in ancient Greek literature. The Roman people of the Eastern Roman Empire, which we call Byzantine, stressed their own supposed Hellenic or Greek identity, even though any sort of homogeneous or continuous Greek ethnicity by that point was meaningless. Alexius is heroic like Achilles, though far less destructive, fortunately. His deeds are larger than life. His life's mission and his labors were to save God's chosen people, the Orthodox Greek Roman Christian Empire, from its enemies. Instead of the fall of a city, as in Troy, or as in Homer, the Alexiad depicts the salvation of a city, although with fear that current imperial policies, i.e. those of Alexius' descendants, would lead to more trials. And so the work is a critique of the imperial policies of her nephew Manuel, who was reigning at the time the work was written, which was at the end of her life in the 1140s. Now, it is important to understand that Byzantine civilization was, in the eyes of its people, the Christian kingdom of God on the earth. Byzantines were fully aware of their special covenant status and of their responsibility to keep the flame of true Christianity alive in the world. Orthodox Christianity has been among the most effective missionary churches in history, as it has proselytized and converted entire nations to the faith. The decline and eventual destruction of their empire naturally provoked a crisis in their understanding as they tried to grasp why God would abandon them. Their own prevailing explanations included the immorality and bad foreign policy decisions of some of the emperors. And so, Anna's classicizing tendencies were part of an effort to promote the achievements of the past and to revitalize her own culture. It would be of particular importance, this is parenthetical, for a modern group that considers themselves the New Covenant people, namely the LDS Church, called to establish the Kingdom of God, to know something about this earlier failure. At minimum, Byzantine attempts to explain their own destruction at the hands of the Turks could be fruitfully compared to the Nephites coming to terms with their fate. So the time is right for Byzantine studies at BYU. To save the Queen of Cities from its enemies, Normans, Turks, and others, heroic measures were necessary. When the treasury was too depleted to pay defensive troops, the Comnenus family tightened their belts and melted down their own jewelry and precious objects into coin. No less was expected from the church, and passages were found in the church fathers to justify the use of church treasures to save the state. Anna's character and interests were, of course, highly unusual. In her funeral oration, and she lived to be in her mid-70s, we learn how Anna's parents encouraged her interest in Greek learning. To a point, however, she was forbidden to study grammar and rhetoric because these subjects were thought to corrupt the youth. Wow, how could grammar be corrupting? I thought it was merely dull. But back then, grammar was taught via often racy passages drawn from pagan Greek literature, much of whose ethos was contrary to that of a good Christian. Take the immoral Olympian deities, for example, and that was the problem. Now, here's a suggestion how to improve student interest in grammar and writing instruction today. Nevertheless, Anna was so hungry for a complete education that she surreptitiously studied these forbidden subjects with palace eunuchs. How could you not admire this woman's thirst for knowledge? As you can surmise from the introduction that I read, she was proud of the results. And without this irregularly obtained education, there might have been no Alexiad, nor something of far greater importance that I shall explain later. Anna had tremendous self-confidence. She felt that her whole life she'd been prepared to succeed her mother as empress, as wife to a strong leader who'd been chosen by her father. She was, after all, Alexius's oldest child, and of all his children, she resembled him most closely. She had been born in the purple, in the porphyra, or purple chamber of the palace, which meant that her father was already in power when she was born, to which was attached a special status. Anna was named after her grandmother, Anna della Sina, whose political maneuverings had brought her family to power in the first place. She was far more intelligent than her brother John, who actually succeeded. She had been betrothed as a child to one designated heir, and when he died young, she was married to another, the talented and intelligent Nikephoros Bryennios, also an accomplished historian with an imperial heritage of his own. She expected that the two of them would succeed her father. There were few Byzantine women who could cherish this kind of hope. She was prepared to murder her brother, the reigning monarch, in favor of her husband, who in the end would have none of it. Ironically, Alexius's own policies perhaps contributed to Anna's justification for trying to seize power. Alexius had created a strong government by making it a family franchise. All the most powerful positions were occupied by people with some family tie, by birth or by political marriage, with him. Women as well as men had influence and responsibility in this dynasty. Thus, Anna thought she could aspire to the highest office. Now, Anna's coup. When Alexius lay dying in 1118, the question of who would succeed him remained unsettled. Throughout his reign, Alexius shrewdly made various politically motivated provisions for the succession. The historian suggests that he leaned toward his son John, but as I shall explain later, he may have pulled off an Alexander the Great ploy here and left his empire to the strongest, i.e., the one who could secure support the quickest. The vivid account of these events by Niketas Koniatis, who died in 1216, is worth reviewing, whose description of events surrounding the succession are usefully compared with Anna's cryptic remarks and provide insight into why her coup ultimately failed. Koniatis' great history begins with the death of Alexius and goes through the fall of the city to the Venetian-led Fourth Crusade. Let's see. He was a critic of Alexis' successors. He described their moral failings and how they led to the fall of the dynasty. One wonders how he might have viewed a woman such as Anna in a position of power. Well, we'll see her ultimate assessment in a minute. Kaniati's view is that Alexius had intended John to be his heir all along, and that Anna and her mother were rebelling against his wishes. That would have wounded Anna, who felt she was honoring her father's wishes. Kaniati states that Alexius had given John the tokens of succession, the red buskins, and had permitted him to be acclaimed as co-emperor. Empress Irene then supported her daughter and systematically attempted to undermine John with her husband, who, according to Kaniates, feigned to listen but deliberately ignored her. A report, however, that is hard to take at face value, since Alexius is known to have relied heavily on his wife's support and advice throughout his reign, especially when his health began to fail. She assumed much of the responsibility of rule. The Empress contrasted the superior qualities of Branius with their worthless son John. Coniates claims that when Alexius had enough of this, he chided her, citing early Roman precedent. When did any Roman emperor set aside a perfectly good son for a son-in-law? Coniates called Alexius a dissembler. No one ever knew his true intentions, and the circumstances around the succession bear this up. One of these ambiguities here is that Branius did have the title Caesar, which was a title that since the time of the emperor Diocletian in the third century had designated a junior emperor who was to succeed his partner, the Augustus. And yet this Augustus had a son, Alexius had a son who was determined to obtain his patrimony. While Alexius lay dying in a move that would have made Alexius proud, as it turns out, John began to gather the support of his extended relatives. The apple falls close to the tree, for this is how Alexius gained power and maintained it himself, since John's own mother was against him and his sister Anna was courting popular support in favor of her husband. Coniates describes how John, while visiting his stricken father on his deathbed and pretending to embrace him, secretly removed the signet ring from his father's hand. Coniates notes that some say this was in accord with Alexius's wishes. John then hurried to the great palace to secure his position. The streets were jammed with citizens who loudly supported him, yet the seat of power, the palace, remained under the women's control. John's swift actions took his mother completely by surprise, his mother Irene. She responded by summoning him, chastising him, and ordering him to desist, since the rightful succession was to his sister and to the Caesar. It's amazing that she expected to be obeyed. John, however, already mostly in command, ignored her. The Empress then urged the Caesar, Anna's husband, to seize the throne and tried to get the supine Alexius to explicitly endorse him, since their son was acting treasonously by seizing the throne while his father still lived. But poor Alexius was beyond caring about mundane things, and his only response was labored breathing. John arrived at the great palace, but the guards, including the fabled Varangians, demanded more proof of his right to succeed than the ring alone. But John's supporters forced open the gates with metal poles, lifting the doors out of their hinges. A crowd rushed in along with John's principal train and began to ransack the palace, a reflection of the chaos that often attends an unsure succession. The gate was quickly closed. John remained barred in the palace for several days, securing his rule, thereby missing the funeral of his father, who died the very next day, in spite of his mother's order for him to attend. He did, however, permit his family supporters to attend. Even in Coniates, who favors John, this unfilial disrespect does not go unnoticed. Coniates says that John, quote, hugged the palace like an octopus clinging to the rocks, unquote, which is a fine Homeric allusion from the Odyssey. During the first year of John's reign, a number of his relatives, organized by his sister Anna, revolted in favor of the Caesar Branius, her husband. They planned to murder John while he was encamped outside the city walls. Branius, however, stalled, and the zeal of the conspirators withered, and so the revolt died. The rebels, however, were not maimed nor flagellated, the usual punishment for insurrection, but their property was seized, though most of them had it restored before long. His sister did not, however. John had collected all of Anna's wealth and her expensive clothes and was about to give it all away to his friend, the Turk, John Aksuk, a childhood friend, who was the grand domestic, the highest office in the land next to the emperor. John is reported to observe that nature had finally reversed things so that he now had the upper hand over his know-it-all scheming sister. But Aksuk refused to accept the gift and persuaded him to forgive Anna and restore her property. The emperor was not going to be bested at being generous to his own family, and so he followed his friend's advice. Bryennius remained faithful to the emperor until his death 18 years later. Anna, however, no doubt perceived as a dangerous for her learning and unwomanly character, was confined along with her mother in a comfortable house arrest in a monastery on the edge of town, which must have been terrible punishment for a woman accustomed to the intellectual and political excitements of court life. Her access to visitors was limited. She complains in the Alexiad how mean her brother and nephew were to her, and she blames John for wearing out her husband on military campaigns that led to his death. According to Coniates, and this is his assessment of her, Anna was so angry with her husband's indecision and spinelessness that she punished him in some obscene manner. The passage is difficult to interpret. One scholar reads it, this would be a little indelicate, I'm afraid. One scholar interprets it as Anna publicly calling her husband an obscene word for the female genitals, accusing him of acting like a woman and wondering why she hadn't been born with the male organ instead of him. Another scholar, and my own reading as a scholar of medical history tends in this direction, interprets the passage to refer to a rare sexual situation painful to both partners that Anna supposedly intentionally wrought upon her husband to punish him. I'll refrain from details, of course. The result, so the account goes, was that she stretched out and blunted his member. Now, why is this prurient report included? You might wonder why I included it in here, but I'm about to explain. And I would have refrained from mentioning it, except that it can be used to make a significant observation about this historian, Coniates, and the sexist society in which he lived. I suspect that this report is mere gossip, as neither Anna nor Bryennius could logically have been the source of such an embarrassing report, if it had in fact occurred. Palace staff may have witnessed it, and they could have been the source, since notions of privacy were very different back then than they are today. In any case, intentionality cannot be imputed to Anna in what seems to be a wholly involuntary medical physiological circumstance. Whether based on fact or not, I suspect that Coniates included the story as his sexist assessment of Anna's failure to take over the government, as well as a reflection, perhaps, of male castration anxiety. His assessment could be summed up as follows. The woman loses on the man's playing field, but exacts her revenge on hers, the bedroom. Women simply do not have what is needed to rule. Coniates has shown this in his account. The man who uses all of his connections, mostly outside the palace, the army, the crowd, the extended family, to secure power is naturally more fit to rule. In contrast, women, cloistered in palaces and homes by nature, cannot secure the necessary support outside palace walls. What then is left for a woman? Well, the bedroom, of course, the only place where men are wholly vulnerable. As I noted earlier, I think we'd motivate more students to acquire good grammar and writing skills if we gave them such examples to study. Anna was determined to have the last word, however, so she began her history, the purpose of which was to depict the true legacy of Alexius and to criticize the policies of his successors. Historians have questioned the historical value of the Alexiad for several reasons, including that it was written by a less than objective woman and is colored by emotion, but also because her chronology is incorrect in some places and her description of some key events, such as her oft-quoted description of the arrival of the Crusaders, are inaccurate. However, it has recently been shown that Anna's treatment of several subjects, including the Crusaders, reflects the concerns of the time when she was writing the book, i.e. in the 1140s rather than the 1090s. Her description fits the circumstances of the Second Crusade, which had passed through Constantinople in the 1140s. Her description of those events was an implicit criticism of how Manuel, her nephew, had handled the later Crusaders. Moreover, she emphasizes her father's condemnation of astrology, his keen distrust of the Western Celts, i.e. the French and German Crusaders, and his Christian virtues as a vehicle to criticize the reign of her nephew. Manuel was notorious for his favor to Western barbarians, his foreign brides, and giving away too many princesses in political marriages to Westerners, which is how many Europeans today can claim descent from Manuel. Also his obsession with astrology and his many mistresses. Some of these, the love for astrology, condemned by the church, and the West-loving in particular, were later blamed for provoking the divine judgment that befell the city in 1204 when it fell to the Venetians and was sacked. Now, the case of astrology. Anna's treatment of astrology is the subject of an article that I'm currently preparing, not for what it says, but for what it does not say. She seems ignorant of the fact that horoscopic astrology had been invented by the pre-Christian Greeks and suggests that it was a later invention and import into Byzantium, although not through Arabic treatises. Now, one of the advantages of studying two cultures in parallel is being able to see connections that perhaps even historical individuals like Anna were unaware of. When she gives a historical sketch of astrology that avoids mentioning Islamic authors, I become suspicious, because it is known from other sources that the great flowering of interest in the Greek sciences that had occurred in the Baghdad Caliphate during the 9th and 10th centuries had a profound effect on intellectual life in the Byzantine world. Through translations, through import of text by Arabic authors, and that Arabic astrology was one area of particular interest. If astrology was so taboo, then we might expect Anna to credit it to, or at least associate it with, a hated group such as the Muslims. You know, they're bringing us all their trash. There's plenty of evidence in the Alexiad that Anna was deeply ignorant of Islam, however. And the Muslim Turks were the enemy at the gates, so how could anything useful have ever come from them? Ironically, however, it was Muslim thinkers who employed the very same techniques that had been developed by pre-Christian Greeks in astronomy and astrology, but which had been forgotten, both the techniques and their origins, by Anna's time, and who were the vehicle for the intellectual revival of the later Greeks. Now, in conclusion, in this society, paradoxically it seems, women could wield power, but without a man, ultimately they would fail. Without Bryennius's cooperation, the Comnenus women's coup was doomed to failure. In some Darwinian sense, John, by having to struggle with family rivals, and prevail, proved himself the more capable of rule than his idealistic sister and her apparently lethargic, but probably rather more realistic husband. John's record as emperor stands out among all the Komnenoi for his military leadership, long-range strategies, and his clemency shown to rivals. His rule was actually quite successful. He was willing to forgive revolts of family members against him, his younger brother Isaac, who had helped him secure the throne, for example. Forgive, yes, but not be incautious, hence Anna's house arrest. Whatever affection there must have been between Alexius and his daughter Anna, it would have broken Anna's heart to realize, when it came to ruling the empire, her father did not place her learning over the political canniness of her little brother, whom she was prepared to murder for the good of the state. Through her learning, writing, and involvement with politics, Anna, of course, crossed into roles traditionally reserved for men. Yet she was also a dutiful wife and mother. She bore at least four children. The author of her eulogy states that she was neither man nor woman, but she became both. The odd thing, however, is that modern feminists who are looking to find in Anna a 12th century feminist critique of medieval Byzantine society will be disappointed. She never suggests that women in general ought to reject their general roles, but only that she and her family, the Komnenoi, need do so, since they have been chosen by God to lead his people. Nevertheless, the life and writings of this remarkable woman deserve to be better known. Under her patronage, scholars studied and discussed the works of Aristotle, Ptolemy, and Euclid, and wrote commentaries on them, which was the medieval equivalent of a monograph. The foundations were thus laid for an even greater society-wide renaissance during the following dynasty, two centuries later, and it was this later Byzantine revival that fed the Italian Renaissance with Greek scholars. Thus, having cultivated and sponsored classical learning at a critical point of intellectual recovery in the Byzantine Empire, Anna deserves to be recognized as one of the intellectual forebears of the Italian humanists. Thank you.
We'd like to thank Professor Cooper, and we do have a few minutes for questions. If anyone has any questions, we could ask. Or we'll just close it for now. Are there any questions you'd like to ask Professor Cooper?
I realize that was a breathless whirlwind tour, and I probably didn't speak slowly enough to be fully understood. But I'll stick around if anybody wants to talk. Yeah, Grant.
It's just odd that she would be criticized for being historically inaccurate, since most of the other historians are also historically inaccurate.
Yes.
And the point is not to be truthful to the facts so much as to make the point.
Mm-hmm.
And so it just struck me as odd that was one of the criticisms modern scholars lay at her side?
I think they do so because there's so much emotion in her account. In my view, that doesn't ruin the account. It makes it more interesting. But that's just not how some of these scholars think history ought to be written. So, and plus that she's a woman. There was even a study about a decade or so ago that tried to prove that she didn't even write the Alexios. All she did was edit her husband's notes. Because how could a woman know about what happened on a battlefield or some of the other things that men do? Well, she knew men. She talked to men. And her battlefield accounts owe more to Homer, actually, than they do to, you know, it's part of the epic thing. Well, I hope that some of you will actually go and read the Alexiad or take a Byzantine history course from me or something.
Well, thank you again for coming in. Next week is the Women's Studies Film Series. 2 weeks from now, we will be meeting here again for the next colloquia, and our student research grant recipients will be presenting for that day. Thank you.
I thought it's interesting that you should make the connection between Byzantium and the Renaissance and the humanists.